Hello, everyone. This is Patrick Zorro. Welcome to the Quant Financial Engineering Podcast. I have this time, it's really a treat. I say all the time I have a treat for you. But this time it's even better than the last time, I think, because we are going off our beaten path a little bit, but getting to talk to Steve Dalton of the 2-Hour Job Searched. And we're going to have a discussion because at the end of the day, you could be the greatest quant in the world, but you still need a job. And who else but Steve Dalton to tell us how to get that job? So, Steve, tell us a little bit about you. Tell us about the book, and then let's get into a conversation.
Absolutely. I'm Steve Dalton, former chemical engineer turned strategy consultant turned MBA. The vision all along was to get my MBA so I could get my dream job in marketing. Got my dream job in marketing, selling delicious Pillsbury biscuits. Realized quickly I hated my dream job. Then realized quickly I had no idea how to find a job when interviews were not provided to me by a career center, which is terrifying when you just hit 30. You feel like this is something you should know. And I realized, wow, I was never actually trained for this. I was trained in resumes and cover letters and interviewing, but not the act of sourcing that first interview, which is the key bottleneck to most people's job search in the postmonster.com era circa 2000, when there were too many applicants for any job, which was a sea change over how it used to be, where we'd have to go to Kinko's and print out resumes on nice paper and mail it off using postage. So when the limits to applying were taken away, employers were inundated. So that's where my obsession with job searching began. I went back to my alma mater at Duke, the business school named Fuqua. Thought I'd just do that career coaching there for international students in particular for a year or two, rediscover my passion, work on a really exciting consulting style project. And I just fell in love with the space. Anything else I could use my brain for felt small in comparison to how important that topic is. It's a universal anxiety, the ability to put food on the table for our loved ones and ourselves, this universal source of anxiety that nobody ever teaches you how to address. So a few years in, the 08 financial crisis hit. I had an insight that led me to develop a process that later became the book called The 2-Hour Job Search. And my career path took a sharp right turn from what I expected it to be, but I'm so grateful that it did.
Great. So you mentioned two things, international students, and obviously lots of international students end up joining, quant programs, but other programs as well. And obviously, I guess it's more heightened for them because it's more difficult because they have to really understand it, but they have to understand quickly what is the most efficient way to get a job. And then you also mentioned this idea of the resume and we don't print the resume anymore. Now we have to go on the internet and it's all digital. So maybe tell us a little bit, I guess, the psychology that you think is going on. Why students find it so attractive, even though it shouldn't be, to just send out thousands and thousands and on LinkedIn or faceless messages with the hope that somehow it's going to reach someone. And then because your book talks about that quite a bit, and it says it's a little bit like the bachelor and the bachelorette situation, it's probably not going to work, but yet they're doing it. Why?
I think because it gives you the illusion of infrastructure. If here, these are the rules, complete these prompts, and the best candidate will win. That's what we believe when we see an online job posting. But in reality, there's no connection or correlation between effort and results when you're applying online. There's simply no way to beat an online application. Even optimizing for keywords, everybody's all in, it says how important that is in resumes. There is zero data that supports that is a positive return on investment to do that activity. But there are certain costs. It costs you time, energy, frustration, your happiness. So I think the appeal is that it provides infrastructure in an otherwise overwhelming situation. For international students, school in the US is already an overwhelming situation. It's all the same workload that the domestic students have, except you're working in a second language and only a fraction of employers will consider you because of visa situations. So the level of difficulty is much, much higher. To me, that was the gap that led me there. the appeal of infrastructure was the insight that led me to develop the process that became the two-hour job search. During the 08 financial crisis, I'll never forget this, and it was in March, there was a student came into my office. She had just been notified by Bear Stearns that she had lost her investment banking offer. It was an international student. So not only did she lose her offer, she lost her visa. And all the other banks kind of knew there was a financial crisis coming, so nobody would talk to her. She stopped searching months earlier. And she said, what do I do now? And I gave her the tips that I was given. This, like, figure out where you've got contacts. Let's get a list of targets together. And she's like, okay, how do I come up with a list of targets? And I realized this is like the dream situation. I have a student who will do exactly what I say, but I didn't have anything exact to say or say to her. That didn't exist in our industry. But in everywhere other element of our lives, YouTube was getting popular at that point. If we drop our phone or if our TV doesn't work, we look up a YouTube video on how to fix it. We don't want tips, we want instructions. But all career services had to offer at that time was tips. So that is what I realized in that moment. She had the ability to follow instructions, but not to curate a bunch of tips into a set of instructions for herself. It should have been my responsibility. I was the one getting paid to be there rather than paying to be there. So I started looking for a set of instructions for this. How do you get an interview? And nothing like that existed. And I realized I was as qualified as anybody, having been an MBA, a strategy consultant, an engineer, breaking big problems down into smaller pieces. So I started using behavioral psychology and economics to create a job search process to provide infrastructure that would serve as an alternative for those online job postings, which are basically just a sugar rush. They have no nutritional value. They give you, I call it the defensive job search. It allows you to have a stat to show off to your support network to prove that you're working at this, that you're trying hard. I completed X number of applications. I spent Y number of hours applying online. Neither of those are leading indicators of success in the job search, however. So retraining the population to embrace better leading indicators by giving them a set of instructions that ensures they make progress in a predictable, positive way. That was really what I set out to do with the two-hour job search.
And obviously, we don't make it easy because a student is in within a university environment. We'll spend, you know, unless they take a professional development class, we'll spend 99% of her or his time studying and basically, as you mentioned, just basically showing that they understand what needs to be done by doing the steps and to show good grades. But then they're saying, well, okay, now I want, what do I need to do to get the job? Give me the steps. And really, most of the time, you're right, there are no steps being given, tips maybe. You know, make sure that your resume has no mistakes. You know, make sure that you have one pager and it's, you know, tips. But really no structure. And it's very difficult because now the student needs to take themselves, because frankly, they need to take themselves out of the curriculum environment, I guess. Mm-hmm. Right?
Absolutely.
And they need to adapt. Talk to us a little bit more about that in terms of what they, you know, the thinking that they need to go through. Even if they look at your book and they follow instructions, they still need to get out and see people, and right, it's not like if you follow the book exactly in that fashion, because the book doesn't know which kind of job you're looking for. It doesn't know who's going to be out there, right? It gives you a structure, but you still need to invent and be creative.
Yeah, I think so much of the book is rooted in the 80-20 rule, the Pareto principle. In most systems, you get 80% of your results in just 20% of the time and effort. But it's just simply not efficient to ask someone to bake a German chocolate cake for the first time that they've, if they're not bakers, here's a list of ingredients, figure it out for yourself. That's cruel. There's no world where that makes sense. Give them a starter recipe. Once they've cooked a basic German chocolate cake, then they can add more chocolate or more coconut next time and make it their own. But giving people a starting point, it helps get over the starting problem. And I think that's a big barrier for most people is, where do I even begin? The job search in the modern era, if you're doing it well, and I call what I do an advocacy-based job search because it's built around building advocacy in a systematic fashion. It's scary. It's uncomfortable at times. It will challenge you in ways that no academic subject will, because it involves getting ignored a lot. It in a sense is a sales process. So not everybody feels comfortable with sales, but it's a lot more comfortable than sell yourself. I will say that for sure. And it's so much easier to ask strangers for the gift of their time when you have a script to follow, when you understand the mechanics of that script, and when you're prepared for the fact that, okay, 70 or 80% of people are not going to respond to me. And that's fine. But we don't have many analogs in modern society where only being successful 20% of the time equates to success. When I was in high school, it was okay for me to get a C, a middle mark, and still that wouldn't ruin my college career. But there's so much less room for error now, as college admissions has gotten more competitive. So we are so terrified of not being 100% great at everything we do, even when we're just starting out. When trying to build advocacy, advocacy doesn't work like that. It's inherently messy and flawed and imperfect, and a lot of times you will invest effort in things that doesn't pan out. So knowing that there's a bunch of slippage and waste in your effort, you need to come out of the gate as efficiently as possible, even if that means you're getting responses 20% of the time instead of just 5% of the time. So I help give people to maximize that those early probabilities when success rates are small, because that's even more important than going from 98% effective to 99%. How do you get from 5% up to 20%?
I will say that the book is quite interesting because it's and I will tell you why it's interesting, because it's not so much Steve Dalton's view of the world, and he says, well, try this. I will tell you that, but very few of some of my students have done that, did that last year. You know, they said, you know, I put a list together and I decided which one I wanted to target, and of course he got a job. And then when I read your book, I said, well, this is interesting. So there seemed to be some sort of a innate truth, I guess, to the job search. It's not one technique and you could try another technique. I think at the end of the day, there is this idea of a list, and you look at that list and you do things to the list and you rank the list, because that's what the student did. Mm-hmm. And when he explained it to the new incoming student, I say, whoa, that's how you did it. But of course, it's not an easy process, because, you know, but you need structure, and that's what the book gives you. But then you need to kind of mold it to your own. It's not a book where at the end, Steve Dalton's going to give you a bunch of questions, and if you answer them right, then you get a job, which is what they used to, unfortunately. This is a book which gives you, you're right. I like the idea of the cooking show, right? You're explaining to them how to make butter and how to make this, and then you're going to have something that's more or less edible. And of course, the more you go at it, because obviously my students, when they come in, they look for an internship.
Yep.
But then after a while, they need to look for a job, right? And not 3 months before your graduation, way before. So there is you against the world, because there's a lot of other tech. I mean, let's forget you mentioned the tips.
Yeah.
That they usually get at the university level, but there's lots of books, you know, especially when they talk about how to, you know, what to put in your resume and the specific word that should be in it, especially with ChatGPT. So according to you, this is not really helping them. It's just reinforcing this idea that somehow you could game the system somehow.
Yes. I would just love to see data that supports that all of this conventional wisdom matters, but there's simply no data that shows that copying and pasting all the words in the job posting and putting it in 1-point font onto your resume in white font so it can't be seen will improve the odds that you get selected to interview. There's no data that supports that, but it definitely takes time and effort. So I think that it's a tip. It's not an instruction, because instructions, you should be able to follow like a recipe. If you follow it exactly as it's laid out, you should have a predictable result. Shrinking down the job posting into 1-point font, you can replicate that, but like, what's the benchmark? How do you know if you're successful when the response rate on an online job posting is 1-2%? So I think it's just very problematic. I think psychologically, where job seekers will get into trouble, And back to the list point, I think it's important to prioritize your efforts because not all targets are worth equal amounts of attention or effort. Once you apply just in a panic to a job you don't really want or a company you don't really like, you want to prevent cognitive dissonance. So if you see a job posting for a role you like slightly better, just to be rational, you need to apply to that one as well because you applied to one you liked even less. That's a dangerous place to get into when you're just sort of applying to everything just to get some sort of acknowledgement that you're trying, just to get some company to pay attention to you. So it's really important before you spend dozens of hours on your job search, spend one to prioritize which companies are worth it enough to you to build advocacy there. Okay, outside of that tier, which ones are kind of on deck when you have time and energy? Who's next that you're going to build advocacy with? And anyone outside of the top 10, you're not going to have time if you follow the recipe that I lay out in the two-hour job search. You will never have time to network with them because you'll be done. You'll have a job by the time you get down that far on your list. So if you want to apply online in your downtime while you're waiting for people to get back to you, absolutely do that. But if you're treating every company equally by applying to those jobs online, you're going to be exhausted and you're going to have very little to show for it. I recommend the 5% rule. If you're hearing back less than 5% of the time on an online job posting, it's not worth your time to apply to things simply because it takes time and energy and effort and distracts you from networking when you're applying to job postings and you don't get smarter. You don't learn anything. So you're not better qualified tomorrow for the effort you put in today. Now, if you're hearing back more than 5%, go ahead and apply first and then network. But if you're not, network first and then apply.
And obviously, psychologically speaking, as you mentioned, it's true that if they don't get back to you, then mentally, right, it becomes, well, they don't want me, but you're barking at the wrong tree and you don't even know it. But it took me so long to send to all these people and to develop, you know, intro letter for every single different job. But that takes a lot of time. I remember doing them myself, you know, when I was to apply. At that time, we had to print the thing, so it would take even longer. So, you know, you have to make sure you change the name, change the address, send it, and nothing happened. Because you say, well, why come they don't want me? So then there is this, so then you have a double whammy where then mentally you get hit. And then, of course, which that's the good thing I like about this book, and this student actually did the same thing as well, and I'm seeing it every day with the students, is that everybody wants to work for Goldman Sachs. And Morgan Stanley. But, oh, these small companies, and you point out in your book, but this is where the jobs are, really. Most of the job, I think, was it 3/4 of the jobs? Almost 3/4 are in this 100 and less company side, right? Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. That's interesting.
That stat I didn't include in the revised edition of the book because I just didn't love the source as much as I had. The source wasn't as reliable as it had been in the past. But there is a common misconception among international students that only big companies will sponsor. I think that's I would reframe that and say only big companies have a standard policy for or against sponsorship that they will share. Other companies will take it on a case-by-case basis, but you'll get attention at smaller competitors to those bigger companies a lot easier than you will the bigger ones. And what you learn from the smaller ones will increase your credibility with the larger ones. So it's this virtuous cycle that you can build of learning. A common phrase that you'll hear me say in my talks and in my LinkedIn group is, if you focus on learning, you will get job leads. If you focus on job leads, you will get neither. And I think so many people lead with the job leads thinking like, yeah, I need this job, but that's not what's going to help people advocate for you. That's not going to build their comfort and trust in you. If you use their time to get to know what they know, like that's going to build trust and advocacy and make you smarter, increasing the odds that you get interviews as a natural byproduct of that. But people aren't trained to do this. You have so many required classes in university, and this somehow is not required. I think because universities... I think because this is viewed as an unsavory topic by the faculty that run universities, there's not a ton of research about it. But I also think there's not been anything to teach. If you were to do a class that was required on it, it would be tips. There were no sets of instructions. There were no frameworks that were really credible. I think no teacher wanted to go up in front of a class and say, put yourself out there and try selling yourself. because they'd get torched in their reviews. So I really wanted to change that. I think there's so much more science to this process of recruiting the advocacy of strangers than there. It's not an art, it is an art and a science. But I think it's important to note that not everybody gets back to you, and that's totally fine. The people who ignore you are generally doing you a favor. It's the people who pretend to be helpful. Those are the dangerous ones. There are three types of contacts you'll encounter when you reach out to strangers to ask them for the gift of their time. You'll have curmudgeons who will never respond to you. You'll have obligates who will respond to you, but out of a sense of obligation rather than an intrinsic motivation to actually help you. So they'll do things like set up meetings with you, but cancel at the last minute. They'll respond sometimes, but not other times. They're motivated by a desire to not lose face. They've probably gotten help in the past, but they don't want to pay it forward because that means risk and inconvenience. So they give you a negative return on investment instead of the zero return on investment that curmudgeons give you. And almost all the benefit, the Pareto principle, once again, 80% of the benefit you get in your job search comes from this third category, a group I call boosters. But they're only about 20% of the population. So you have to kiss a lot of frogs to find that prince. But that prince is so worth your while. It just is a different kind of challenge than any other academic subject a student is acclimated to at this point in their academic careers, because it's inherently messy. People are going to reject you and turn you down and not be nice to you and criticize you and tell you why this is your fault. They're not helping you. And there's nothing you can really do about that except try somebody else. If you go one person at a time, you will go insane though. So you need to work at scale. And that's why you need to start with a list and work multiple employers simultaneously. But absolutely one of those should be Goldman Sachs if that's your dream employer. You just need to have other ones alongside it that will help you get traction and build your knowledge base.
You did it again. You mentioned kissing a frog. And I will tell you that one of my better students, you're onto something, because one thing he mentioned to me is that looking for a job, he says, it's like getting married, right? You're not just going to grab anyone off the street and say, hey, you want to get married? And accept an answer, right? So, and he said that basically you need that relationship with that employer. And it cannot just be on the basis of a paper. I mean,
right.
In my case, where it's very helpful is that I tend to introduce a student to the employer because they know me, they know the program, they know what they worked on. Maybe the students has worked with that particular sponsor, so they have an idea. So that helped things along. Mm-hmm. But again, that's part of this idea that you need to form a relationship. You cannot possibly get a job by sending 5,000 resumes, getting one interview on a piece of paper, and somehow you think, and even if you get the job, and this is something that I've seen many times, often students will get jobs like that, but then they don't stick around. They don't stay that long because they realize I didn't like the overall environment of the firm. People weren't nice, you know, things that you can't possibly get when you get an interview. So it is like getting married.
It's pretty common to hear job seekers these days talk about how they're so anxious or stressed that they'll apply to jobs they don't even want. And I mean, how self-defeating is that? Like, that just doesn't make any sense. Why spend your limited time and effort on those companies when it's the same amount of time and effort to pursue companies that you really genuinely want rather than ones that you don't want? But I think it's just that it's that appeal of infrastructure. I think the marriage analogy makes a ton of sense. You need to signal your value, and you need to get to know them as a person, because that's what builds the trust and advocacy necessary to get an interview. There's really nothing in it for them other than that intrinsic motivation. It feels good to help others in need, but not every person that you'll engage with responds to intrinsic motivation to help job seekers. But the ones who do give you a disproportionate amount of your help, to approach people who are intrinsically motivated is fundamentally different than a lot of the conventional wisdom in the job search, like sell yourself, put yourself out there, talk about your top accomplishments. It's weird because it's already jarring enough for international students coming to the US where self-promotion is much more common. And then all of a sudden, the self-promotion has to stop when you're doing networking with strangers, like because you have to take an interest in what they know. It's actually much more of a return to form to more collectivist societies rather than individualistic like the US is. But like, it's so confusing. How do you know when you're supposed to sell yourself and when you're not? the easy answer is don't sell yourself, like ever. Don't do it until you get to the interview, and not even at the start of the interview should you sell yourself. Wait until you get to like, why do you want this job? Like then start selling a little bit, but sell yourself. I don't see a single comment do more damage to the international students that I work with than sell yourself, because it puts so much pressure on them to do something that is deeply societally uncomfortable. The easiest way to minimize the pain is to fully memorize an answer, so you're not exposing a lack of language skill, which you have a language skill, and you're much more probably most international students are much more sensitive about their language skills than their employers or coworkers are. But by fully memorizing an answer to a question like, tell me about yourself, you can come off as kind of robotic and scripted and not very engaged. And it's a minefield of a bunch of things that can go wrong. So it's a really different topic that requires a different approach than brute force. Let's stay up more hours and work harder and apply to more jobs. And it's different than that. It's much more of an art. That element of it is an art, but you need to approach it with the efficiency of a science.
Yes. And in addition, an additional layer that I've started adding for, especially for international students, is even if you get the interviews, it's a great small company and it's going to be good for you. Then you go and talk to these people. A lot of, and this is not their fault because, that's the way, American way of talking and speaking. For example, we'll use our first name a lot. Mm-hmm. Certain international students will feel that that is rude and they may use the last name, or they will tend, and I've seen that happen, they will tend to agree a lot. Mm-hmm. And with Americans, if you're saying yes too many times, it's almost like, are you joking? Are you being facetious? But this is not the intent. And this is where I think there's also a need to explain to students, how to, for example, don't stand too close to the interviewer in case you have the physical, or not too far away either.
Yeah.
And don't yes them to death because don't just answer what they want you to answer. So after all that work that they've done, they read your book, they did everything right, but then they still need to get in front of that person and come across the right way, which is not the most obvious thing to do. What do you think? So basically, let's say they do all this right, they get in front of the interviewer. Is FaceTime, I mean real FaceTime, equal networking time? I mean, can you do networking without seeing the person?
You could, but I don't recommend it. I Zoom is a gift that we all got. It's one of the few things in life, yes, apart from the needing to update it every time you open it. Apart from that, it is like a purely good thing that we've all benefited from. We get to stay in closer touch with our loved ones. So many good things. It is so preferable to the phone, where it's more common to talk over one another because you don't have any way of signaling that you'd like to speak. It just gives you more visual information, so that reducing the risk of miscommunication. And if you are working in a different culture, like, that is especially important. If you were neurodivergent, that is especially important. The more data points you have, the better. So you do need to interact with people in real time. You can't build advocacy over email only. So it has to be by phone or Zoom or in person. A lot of people don't want to meet with strangers in person. So I'd say that one's relatively uncommon. But given the choice between the phone and Zoom, I'd take Zoom every day, all day, 100 times over. It's so much better than the phone used to be. And now a lot of people are uncomfortable with the phone, bad reception and no eye contact. You can't really get a sense of a person as well. So absolutely embrace Zoom.
And, and I'm going to finish with this is, and there's also another element that I think, and I'd like to get your take on that, is, so how would you teach a class like this, right? I mean, I know it is challenging to begin with, because at the end of the day, you teach it, they don't get a job, they say, what a waste of time. But then if it's in a classroom environment, which, because I was online and I think I'm going to take it in a classroom environment, I realized that, you have all these students and they're kind of competing with each other in a weird kind of way, which limits the amount of interaction you would want for them to share best practices. Oh, you interviewed, you sent a, oh, I'm going to send a resume to that company as well. No, no, don't do that, because now they're going to see two resumes. But yet, I at the same time, I want them to, well, but share, for example, students sometimes will get, if they post something on LinkedIn, they'll get approached by a headhunter, for example, mm-hmm. for what they've done. So that's a great thing, because at least you get exposure. But at the same time, they say, well, don't apply to this job because, you know what, they don't sponsor, for example. But sometimes they'll hesitate in sharing information within the class itself, because obviously they're competing with each other.
I would argue that by embracing the principles of the two-hour job search, by embracing an advocacy-based job search, you can grow the pie. It's not about fighting more efficiently for that single piece that everybody knows is out there. There are so many companies, and you each have such varied interests. There are topics you learn about for free in your spare time. I want to find a way to get you paid for that. And it's all of you aren't reading up on investment banks in your spare time. Some of you have other, like you like mobile gaming, or you like autonomous vehicles or battery storage, or there are other subjects that you feel strongly about. That's a hint you should probably head in that direction. You synthesize information about those topics easily. That means you'll establish credibility with someone in that space quickly. There's so much good that comes from that. But in a classroom setting, to me, when I teach this process, when I coach people one-on-one, for example, the meetings are never more than 30 minutes long. It's 10 minutes. Here's what your homework will be. Sometimes we're done in 10 minutes. Your first task is going to be to brainstorm 40 employers. Here are four techniques for brainstorming 40 employers. What questions do you have about this assignment? Okay, that's your assignment. We've got 10 minutes left in our meeting. What questions do you have for me? It could be about resumes. It could be about anything else. I'm happy to do that with time remaining in my appointments, but I don't want anything to delay the act of initiating outreach to smart people who have the job you want one day, because that's ultimately what gets you interviews. So for me, the class format would be very modular. Our class today is going to be about the lamp list, or it's going to be about brainstorming employers, depending on the duration of it. The next class will be about sending a 6-point email, the types of contacts, and how do you message an intrinsically motivated contact to maximize the chance that you get their engagement and response. So that, to me, like, you only learn by doing, like you said. There are certain elements that lend itself to classroom exercises, but a lot of it is just facing down the fear of pushing yourself in uncomfortable ways. You'd be surprised to know how difficult brainstorming 40 employers is for many job seekers. And the reason it's so challenging is not because there are not tools that will do that easily. You could ask ChatGPT, what are 40 companies like Goldman Sachs? And it will give you a list. And you could narrow it down. Show me just the ones that are based in the US. Show me just the ones that are like have over 100 employers. Like, it can do that for you. But the problem is that you have to figure out what you're willing to concede on first. There are not 40 perfect companies. There may be 5 or 10 that you consider perfect. But after that, what's more important to you? Is it location? Is it brand name? Is it the kind of work you'd be doing? And struggling with that to figure out what are you really trying to accomplish here with this search, that's painful for some people. Other people have no problem with it at all. They embrace the 80-20 rule. But then they have trouble sending emails to total strangers asking them for the gift of their time. And some people have no problem with that, but they have a lot of problem managing an informational meeting. And these are each very different skills that I lay out exact instructions for. You can struggle with one step of the process, but have an easy time with many others. Everybody's going to struggle with a different piece. So I like teaching it like a modular thing. Here's your challenge today. It's a creativity challenge. Come up with 40 employers. Here's how. Or it's an interpersonal challenge. Manage an informational meeting. Here's how. Go do that, report back, and then we can debrief as a class. But that's really why the two-hour job search is structured in a linear fashion. It's meant to be almost like a video game. You don't go to the next level until you pass this level.
That's, you know what? That's how I teach it as well. I you're right. It lends itself step by step by step. And as you go through them, you realize, oh yes, of course. It was there all along. It's just that you didn't see it. And what the book does well is that it really brings it, it brings it together quite well. Any parting comments for students out there? What should they do and know, and what they shouldn't be afraid of, and especially with the environment that we're in with ChatGPT and everything going so much faster?
Yes. We are all just assistant coaches. You are the head coach of your search. You have to decide which assistant coach's information is credible. You are a CEO in this. So if what I'm saying resonates, great, give it a try. If what I'm saying doesn't resonate, you know, and you choose to listen to other coaches, that's fine too. But pay attention to the feedback you're getting from the marketplace as you take steps. For me, any intimidating undertaking I encounter, I want to follow instructions. I don't want to try to curate tips into a usable format. I want to let an expert tell me what to do. Start there, and then I can innovate from within that basic level of knowledge. So if you are finding this whole process overwhelming, it's a lot less overwhelming if you're following instructions. Those instructions won't be fun or comfortable at every point, but this is a skill like riding a bike or learning to swim. Once you learn it once, you will use it for the rest of your career, and you will not live in fear of it. Because it's the same skill you will use to get a full-time offer from your internship, because you'll need to do coffee chats with people who work at your as peers to your boss, because getting your boss's endorsement, that is table stakes. Everybody's expected to have that. You need to have peers of your boss recommend you too. And once you start your full-time job, you need to use the skill of recruiting advocacy to get promoted at the head of your class or retained if, heaven forbid, there are layoffs. And when you get more experience in your career, it's the same skill you'll use to sell business or to develop knowledge that you need to get a particular task or job done. So it will keep coming back for you. Just learn it now. Learn to swim now. Learn to ride the bike now. And it will bring you so much joy later in your career. And it's actually a unique novel skill that you won't learn elsewhere in your academic program. Embrace it. It is liberating once you have it. So it's short-term intimidation and discomfort, but you've done that before. You came over to the US to work in a second language. This is a drop in the challenge bucket for you. It's just a different kind of challenge. Embrace it, and you will be a superhero on the other end, I guarantee you.
Wow, this is powerful, actually, because the name of the book is not the 2-hour first job search. It's a 2-hour job search. You're right. Even after you get that first job, you should still be using that to move around even after you have your first job. That is totally true. Steve, we could go on all day with this. We have to stop, at least for now.
Yes,
I want to
absolutely.
Thank you. I want to thank you for your time. We have a lot in common. Hopefully, students listen to this and have a better understanding and less fear as to what's going on. Steve, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.